Peter Webster is now going to speak. He is my other IHR colleague, the editorial controller for the British History Online project, which this conference is really part of. And he has been benchmarking British History Online. He also is a historian from the University of Sheffield, and before he came here, he worked for the AHRB Russian Visual Arts Project in the Sheffield Humanities Research Institute. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Okay. In recent years, as the volume of, as we're seeing, as the volume of electronic resources in humanities has continued to burgeon, so I think as interest in assessing the impact of this astonishingly rapid set of developments, as we're seeing at this conference. In the last 12 months alone, launches of very high-profile resources such as the online Oxford DNB have been paralleled by conferences such as this one, the recent Digital Resources and Humanities Conference in Lancaster, a major review by the British Academy, and the establishment of the AHRC ICT strategy projects. Part of this process of assessment must necessarily involve the development and marshalling of the methods by which we are to garner the data we need. The user survey is still available to us, and it, as we've already seen, is being used in very fruitful ways by Dr. Anderson. Also, the use of deep log analysis, the reconnection of raw page view data for online resources with the data about their users, is being employed by David Nicholas and colleagues, and by the forthcoming Lyra project directed by resources for the medieval and early modern periods. The project is funded by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and is currently in its major establishment phase. British History Online, I think, is slightly unusual amongst digitisation projects in that our brief is to concentrate on the digitisation of pre-existing primary and secondary sources from a wide variety of providers in a common markup and delivery format. And you can see on the left of the screen there a sample of some of the different material we're using, parliamentary journals, volumes from the Victoria County History, resources for urban and metropolitan history. These sources are made cross-searchable, and part of the project brief is to monitor the ways in which these previously discrete sources are being configured together by the users. This paper then falls into two parts. The first part reports on the findings of case study research conducted under the aegis of the project into the effects of digital resources and historical research widely conceived. And the second part discusses the implementation of a new tool on British History Online and how the monitoring of its use may provide useful evidence of the impact of the site. Okay, the first part then. A pilot review was carried out during April and May 2005 amongst British History Online's project partners, using extensive interviews with historians both at the directorial and the research levels. I'm going to present some of the findings here of the review as they relate specifically to practices of resource discovery. The review suggested that the impact of digital resources on history has not actually been uniform, no surprise there perhaps, and depends on the type of research being undertaken and the type of resource being sought. And I think in many ways this may amplify quite a few of the things that Ian Anderson has been saying this morning. It should be stressed that these are very much the findings of a pilot review, and we're looking to extend this study to a wider field of scholars in the next few months. The impact then of electronic aids to resource discovery, according to this initial sample, seems to vary along two different axes. That is to say, the difference between primary and secondary sources, and secondly, the individual nature of the work of each researcher. If we consider first secondary sources, several of the scholars interviewed had in common the fact that they had a primary area of research which was relatively easily definable and recognisable, and which tended then to have an established infrastructure of seminars, conferences, dedicated subject research centres in that area. Following on from that, it was also the case that these subject areas tended to have an accumulated back bibliography of secondary sources already published, and in identifiable specialist bibliographic aids, such as the online ones and past online. As a result of this, the amount of speculative activity in pursuit of newly published secondary literature was, it seems, relatively limited, of this information tended already to be harvested through these personal contacts, attention to a limited number of known periodicals, and through seminar and conference attendance. This may be contrasted perhaps with the experience of some county historians. The sources for, English local history and county history may clearly be defined in terms of their subject, but are extremely varied in terms of the agency of their production and the means by which they're disseminated. It's thus necessary for a county historian to consult a very wide range of resource discovery tools for secondary sources. They may include in no particular order printed or online catalogues of specialist publishers, online bibliographies of a general scope, such as the Royal Historical Society Bibliography of British and Irish History, library open access catalogues of relevant libraries, and so on. In addition, as there are for local history, a very great many of local and family history websites maintained by lay historians. This is where search engines such as Google and others may be used very profitably to locate those additional sources. What I'm attempting to do is just to point up something of a contrast between these two situations, and this would seem to suggest that there is a need to analyse and to triangulate resource discovery behaviour in a very impressionistic and individual way with the particular needs of individual researchers. It also suggests that assuming the self-evident usefulness of one tool or other should probably be avoided. Moving on to primary sources, in many ways a similar picture begins to emerge. In some types of research, due to the settled nature of the questions that were being addressed, there exists a known core of essential primary sources, the existence, physical location, and potential uses of which are already relatively well known. Furthermore, with the majority of these, particularly those large, bulky, often manuscript sources, the likelihood of them being newly available in digital form is relatively small, at least at the moment. It's therefore relatively unlikely that these scholars would speculatively use paper or electronic resource discovery methods to check on spec whether an electronic surrogate of their known source was available. This then suggests that despite the impact of the various methods of resource discovery, an element of proactive publicity is still going to be necessary to make electronic versions of these sources available to their users. In a sense, we can't rely on the search engines to do our publicity work for us. There isn't yet an expectation that a source will be available digitally, at least I don't think yet. In contrast to this, there is one particular area in which electronic resource discovery has made a very clear and significant impact, and that is for county and local historians and the access to archive site that Chris was talking about. For each county, there is a very large and amorphous body of material peculiar to the county, usually in the local record offices. A2A has speeded up the process of locating these resources in those main county record offices while allowing this remote consultation of what were previously typescript catalogues. In addition to this, A2A also affords the simultaneous locating of relevant material in record offices other than the main county one. It is already the case that many record offices hold registers of relevant material they know about held elsewhere. However, for these remote items, already known through these registers, it's often the case that they are more fully documented on A2A, and so it is possible to judge the relevance of a source without the need for a visit or a telephone or email contact. Concluding this section briefly then, it has long been possible to survey and categorise user groups according to gender, institutional rank, and the various categories. The initial findings of this review suggests that habits of resource discovery are not only conditioned by these factors, important though they are, but also very much by the specific research needs of individuals. If these findings are at all representative, it seems likely that electronic resource discovery is only likely to be adopted when those methods offer something that is qualitatively different than something that is already available in other forms. In particular, we should perhaps not assume that perceived barriers to the adoption of these resources are to do necessarily with technical skill or simple unwillingness on the part of people to embrace the new. but may also be related simply to the perception or otherwise of an actual real need to change what one does. The second part relates to a new facility which we've recently implemented on British History Online, which may afford one method of tracking the uses made of a resource such as ours. The British History Online bookshelf facility, which you can see in the top, well, you can see a link to it in the very top, allows all registered users to save, as it were, text components of the site's content into a password-protected space. And this is an example of one I created earlier. They're then able to organise their content into folders, as it were, give the thing a title that is meaningful to them, and then return to these at future logins. These are then kept indefinitely. So far, 128 academic users and 442 personal users, as we categorise them, have taken advantage of the facility so far, which is not an enormous sample size, but one with which one can begin to work. It seems to me that there are a number of possible analytical uses of this tool. Firstly, it is possible to be certain here that we have attributed a particular set of actions to a particular individual, which is more difficult, but not impossible, with traditional log analysis, given the difficulty of dealing with multiple users using the same machine at different times. We are also able to see which of the initial search results that someone may retrieve are actually deemed to be useful in a particular. And so in a sense, we see a refined set of search results here, given the some assessment and selection from the user. We're able to categorize these according to the categories that our registered users register under, they being along the lines of academic or personal, and a very broad geographical location description as well. Crucially, I think, we're able, when it is provided, to see the user's own designation of the meaning of a particular set of resources. And so here I've called this second folder here York Clergy, and this is a search for the early 16th century Archbishop of York, Edward Lee. Whilst assessing these will still necessarily be impressionistic, and one doesn't want to put too much weight on one's interpretation of someone else's designation, however, it does get us closer than the simple analysis of search terms, I think. From British History Online's point of view, the additional advantage of this is that it allows us to examine the ways in which these previously discrete sources that we've digitised on the site are being configured together under particular research rubrics. So in my example here, I can see that using various volumes of the Fasti Ecclesiae and Ricane, listing of higher clergy, I can see that Lee was variously a Chancellor at York, a Chancellor at Salisbury, numbers 1 to 4. He was also an Archdeacon of Colchester, number 5, Prebendary at Lincoln Cathedral, 3. These are all previously separated volumes which weren't indexed together in any meaningful sense. It's also the case I've managed to find references to him in Victoria County history material as well, numbers 2 and 6, both of which are relating to various property transactions and so on. There are, of course, limitations to the project. Firstly, this is necessarily a self-selecting sample of users, of those who are technically adventurous enough to engage with the tool in the first place, and who are not averse to the idea of becoming a registered user in principle. And it should be said that by no means the majority of people who use the site become registered users. Secondly, due to the fact that this is quantitative analysis, it's relatively impressionistic. This is likely to remain a small-scale, relatively time-consuming tool with which to assess what people are doing, certainly when set against the size of data sets that may be addressed using log analysis. These limitations noted, however, we do hope this tool, along with an extended program of interview investigations as outlined in the first part of the paper, may begin to allow us to assess the ways in which British History Online is being used. We see these pilot projects as possible methods of addressing the particularity of user behaviour and as complements to the various other qualitative and quantitative methods we've heard about so far. They are, however, at a very early stage, and we would very much welcome any comments and feedback that anyone would have on them. Thank you.